Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we are focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to Drive On. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and today my guest is Carl Porfirio. Carl is a Gold Star father and author of the book, My Daddy's Heart is Purple. And he's here today to discuss the loss of his son, Senior Airman Trey Porfirio, and how his book is honoring the memory and legacy that his son left behind. So welcome to the show, Carl. I'm really glad to have you here.
Thank you, Scott. I'm honored to be here. I appreciate you asking me on. Give me an opportunity. Absolutely. Always looking for the opportunity to talk about my son.
I know. And before we started recording, we shared how, we both have a, common connection being, part of a Gold Star family. And that's one of those titles that nobody wants to have, put on them. But once when you have it, there's no taking it off. There's no giving it back, unfortunately. And with that, I'd like to give you a moment to honor your son and his memory. Can you tell us a little bit about him and who he was?
So my son, Trey, he always wanted to serve in some capacity. He said either he's going to be an LEO or go to the military or something. I remember, we're from Tennessee, and I remember, taking him, there was Coast Guard recruitment station or something. We went in, he was probably about 16, and they said, we don't need anybody. That's like, what? No. We're full. We don't need anybody. And they gave him a mug or something. And I'm like, wow. Okay. And then, I always wanted to, so I love the mountains. We're from Tennessee. I love the mountains. We, the Smokies, we got the Appalachians. But, everyone from Tennessee, once a year, we go to the beach. So I take boys to the beach, everybody goes. And I said one day, I took my finger and I said, there's got to be a sleepy little town. I mean, we're poor. So I said, there's got to be a sleepy little town that I can afford by the beach, So I traced my finger down and I found St. Mary's, Georgia. And I inquired a few people about it. And now, I didn't know that was the home of Kings Bay for the Navy. I didn't know that was the home of Kings Bay Submarine Base because, it's just called St. Mary's. And then it's, sure. But I didn't know anything about it. And not being from a military family myself so much, I just didn't know. So I went, took the kids, went down there, went to the beach, did a look-see. He said, yeah, this is where I want to be. It took about 2 years. Went down there. He went to a real nice high school. He loved it down there. And then we went to the recruiters again. He was about to, before he graduated, about a year before he graduated. And he was in the NJROTC for 3 years in high school. And he went on a sea cruise. And my son was like 6 foot. Time was probably 6'2" or whatever. And he came back. He goes, Dad, I can't join the Navy. I'm too tall. He goes, I keep hitting my head. Every time I go through a gangway, I hit my head. And I always wondered why all the guys in my town were so short. And the Navy guy, as a rule, because it's pretty cramped in a submarine.
Sure.
If you've ever been in a submarine, it's very cramped. Yeah. I went on one too. And I said, not for me. I'm too claustrophobic. But we went toward the Army, toward the, and everything. And I selfishly thought, Air Force, nothing will happen to you in the Air Force. Nothing will happen to you in the Air Force. You'll be safe in the Air Force, And sure. He said, so we checked out the Army, and he said, and I knew if I suggested it, with a teenager. So I kept my mouth shut. And then he said, well, let's go check out the Air Force. And I was like, so we did. And the recruiter, it was a little cocky, but, sat down and kind of did the early enlistment, and it's really what he wanted to do, serve. And, of course I was all for it. And, I just told the recruiter, I said, find my son a good job. And, he got the call right at graduation. He didn't even get that last summer after high school graduation. He went straight in. He got like 2 weeks at the most, went straight in. So, that's what he always wanted to do. And that's what he did.
And that's great that he was able to find something to serve his country in a way I know it's kind of what you wanted to, like, you're like, okay, if you're going to do this, do it here, be safer. But, you know, he kind of found that path on his own. And it's always interesting to hear how people find their way to whatever it is that they end up doing. And this, that was a great story. Thank you for sharing, you know, just that little snapshot into his life and who he was. In the beginning, I mentioned the book that you wrote, which again is My Daddy's Heart is Purple. Right. And as a grieving parent, you know, you lost your son, like we said, you wrote this book designed to be a children's book, right? How did you balance the gravity of the topic of, you know, losing your son over there, while keeping it still on topic for a children's book, something that I don't want to say children's friendly, but, you know, there's a you know, a degree of what they're able to kind of process and handle.
Well, I was a single dad. I was a single dad, not by choice, but, and so I had all my boys and, you know, it's like, hey guys, you got to figure out something to do here. You got to go to college. You got to go to work. You got to do something. And it's funny. I always said when my kid was little, I always went by dad and me. I even had on my tag, dad and me this, dad and me that. And I thought up this book and I said, I'm going to write a series called Dad and Me. And I started to, but I never did. It never came to fruition. I never did it. And I always said, so that really didn't carry on to this. This was almost, so my son left behind a son. Let's preface it with that. My sure. son left behind a son. He was 8 months old when my son passed. So my son got shot 3 times in Afghanistan, but he did make it home only to pass away later after many surgeries and all that. And anyway, so he left behind a son and I said, well, my grandson's mother just wouldn't talk about my son. We didn't want to talk about him. Didn't want her son to know about my son. And it was torture for me. And she did let me see my grandson after a year. I went about a whole year and I got to see him and everything and got to bond with them. And, yeah, he was my whole heart. And so I said, you know, I wasn't allowed to talk about him. And it was almost like a dream that I dreamed up this book. I mean, I like literally, I don't know how it was. And I went out on my back porch. I had a nice screen and porch after I moved down here to, you know, up here to Georgia. In North Georgia, and I came up here because my grandson lives up here. He lives in the Atlanta area. So that's why I moved and came up here. And, I just went out and just started picking out a book, and it's just a short book. You could read it in 5 minutes. It's a children's book. And I wanted to express to a child what a purple heart was, because my son did receive his purple heart before he passed.
Okay.
So I've never even got to see it. I've never seen it in person. She's got it. I've never got to see it, but I know got it. And I don't know where I came up with it. You know, I'm telling you, I can't. It's like it just boom. It just like came to me like a thunderstorm, all at once. And I mean, I couldn't stop typing. I just banged this book out, and you know, and I went and self-published it. Like I said, I didn't think anybody would see the book except my grandson. Mm-hmm. It was grandson. And next thing I know, somebody's sending me a picture of their child holding the book, and we love your book, and it's got 5 stars on Amazon. I'm freaking out. I'm like, I mean, I was just crying. I was like, I wasn't prepared for somebody else to be into this story, somebody else to be into my life with this. I wasn't prepared for that other than my family. And, you know, I didn't want to go around known as, oh, there's the guy who lost his son. You know, I didn't want to be that person.
Right.
And, you know, like I said, I was surrounded by the military. I lived in Kings Bay. My son, you know, was in the NJROTC, and I was surrounded by it. Everybody I worked with was either a Navy wife or in the Navy, in the Coast Guard. It was, you know, so, and I had moved across the river to Florida because I couldn't look at the uniforms anymore. These were kids that my son went to high school with, right, basically. And anyway, back to the book. So I wrote the book. I was freaking out because the book was about to come out. And I said, oh my God, what am I going to do when she finds out this book is out? And I wouldn't even mention my grandson. I wanted to call the little boy in the book Landon. That's my grandson's name. But I was afraid to. I said, oh, she'll come after me. She'll sue me. I've heard these horror stories from other actually gold star parents who never get to see their grandchildren. It's tragic. I have appealed to some members in Congress and said, you've got to write a bill saying when these grandparents, you know, such as your parents, if they lose a child, a son or a daughter, that they still have access to those children, to their grandchildren. Because I have ran into other gold star parents, they never get to see their grandchildren. So I guess I'm fortunate. You know, people say, oh, you're lucky. And it kind of insults me. People say, you're lucky you get to see your grandson. I'm like, oh, I'm lucky? I mean, should I not be entitled to see my grandson? You know, the son of my son that sacrificed his life. And I know. So,
yeah, that is tough. Having not only the loss of your son, which is obviously permanent, but then also having that loss as well of not being able to see your grandchildren. Just as to me, it seems like it's pouring salt in the wound. You know,
it is definitely,
you know, I mean, I understand life circumstances happen and maybe, you know, someone has to move to another part of the country or something like that. And maybe you don't see them as often as you would like for, you know, life happens. I get that. But if you're within the same, you know, local geographic region within a, you know, at least a couple hours drive, it should be
but I was.
That's true.
I wasn't. So I moved.
And so you did what you needed to do, right?
You're emotional. They tell you, I'm too emotional of a person. I'm Italian. It comes from my dad. My mother's German. She's not emotional at all. She's just, and I'm like, I see why they were. I mean, my dad was like the sweetest. He's like, he never met a stranger. I mean, my mom's nice too. I don't want to disturb my mother, but she's it's not the same. You know, we're Italians. We got to kiss everybody. We got to hug everybody. I got to be careful not to, kiss and hug the wrong people. And, you know, then COVID came and, oh my God, don't even get near me. So, you know, kind of hard being the Italian guy. And, you know, I always taught my sons never to be ashamed, never to be ashamed. One time my son came home for a visit, you know, from the Air Force before he deployed to Afghanistan, he came home for a visit and I dropped him off at the airport and he got out of the car and he kissed me. And I was shocked. I was shocked. You know, I was like, wow. You know, it just translated, you know, and, you know, I still, as old as I was, father lives in Italy and, you know, I still kiss my father and everything. I never kiss my mother. It's like, what you doing?
Right.
What? Yeah, she's different. And, you know, but my dad was always the huggy kissy guy. And, you know, so I just became that guy with my sons. I'm like, I love you. I love you. You know, the last words I said to my son was, I love you. And so I'll never regret that because that was the last words I spoke to him. And so, you know, it's just something. I'm too emotional. Some parents, you know, grandparents can see their grandkids once a year and they're just happy with it. And I just felt at that time I needed to be close to him. It was more about me, I'm sure, because, you know, he was an extension of my son.
Yeah.
And that's what I needed to be. You know, I just wanted to be in his life and I wanted him to be in my life. So I moved around, chased him around, gone broke, moving and moving and moving. And now he's about to turn 14 and he doesn't speak to me because he's a teenager. And he's always got a phone in his hand and a game in his hand. And Fortnite is, you know, wait a minute. You know, so I'm like, okay, now I can die in peace, I guess. I don't. But
I have a 14-year-old of my own, so I'm familiar with the
dynamic. I'm sorry. A girl or a boy?
A boy.
Does he speak to you?
He does, yeah.
You're lucky.
Yeah. But, I mean, we're trapped in the same house, so it's kind of, like, inevitable that eventually he's going
to... Well, my grandson comes over. I finished the room upstairs. I said, this is your room. There was a room over the garage. I said, this is going to be your bedroom when you come to visit. And I finished the room. And he like, walked him up the stairs. He was so excited. It's a great big room, like decorated in all Star Wars, you know, vintage Star Wars and all stuff. And he, you know, now he comes over, goes straight up the stairs. Never see him until he comes down for dinner. And I usually have to call him three times for that. Comes down, eats dinner, inhales it. He's back up the stairs. I don't see him. His mother comes and picks him up. Bye. And that's it. I don't see him. And it's like he's, you know, he's got a computer and he can do his fingers on his computer and his other hand on his phone. And I don't know how he does it, but he does it. So I don't know. I don't understand how they do it.
Yeah. So let's, you know, kind of going back to the book and kind of what your, what you and your family kind of went through. I know when I lost my brother in Afghanistan, just a couple months before your son was killed, you know, obviously there's a sadness, right? That's a given with any loss like that. There's just going to be that kind of sadness. But then there's, on the other side, there's, at least for me anyways, there's a sense of pride with the way that he died. He died fighting for his country. I think I had mentioned to you that he had reenlisted so that he could go to Afghanistan and be with the guys that he served with previously in Iraq. So, you know, there's that kind of noble pursuit that he was going after, right? And that's a difficult dynamic to digest, especially when you're talking to children who might not understand. They may understand like good and bad and you know, evil and you know, the good guy and the bad guy and that type of thing.
Exactly.
How do you kind of break down that dynamic and you know, or did you even you know, try to attempt to break down that dynamic you know, as far as children go?
Actually, I did. The preface of my book, let's see, on the back it says, because his son also left behind a son, the goal was for all children who have experienced this loss can also share the pride, which you just said, pride of their parents who loved and served their country.
Right.
So, you know, I got to go read this book to 600 elementary school students, and they were very, you know, and, you know, some of the kids raised their hand and go, well, were, you know, like, were you sad? Well, yes, of course I was sad. But exactly what you said, like your brother and your pride in yourself that you serve. And, you know, your brother, I've said this many times. A lot of people don't get it, but you'll get it. I have the privilege of saying my son died for his country. My son died honorably. My son, you know, there's many ways you can die. And, I think Seth MacFarlane made a movie about that, 1,000 Ways to Die. Anyway, and you know, everyone said, I bought him a motorcycle when he was in high school, and being a single dad, I said, okay, I can be cool dad now. I can, you know, because wife was going to say, hell no, you ain't getting the kid a motorcycle. So he came to me one day and he goes, Dad, and because we lived in Florida and it's flat as a ribbon and the roads are straight, and I never would have bought him one in Tennessee, but I said, yeah, we live in Florida now. The roads are straight. If he wrecks in sand and not in concrete. And, you know, so everyone, he's going to get killed. Well, no, he got killed in serving his country. He didn't get killed on the motorcycle. So there, you know, and so I'm fortunate in that respect. I always say I'm fortunate. My son didn't die a drug dealer. My son didn't die from drugs. My son didn't die in a gang fight. My son didn't die, you know, he died honorably. He's in a cemetery with honorable men and women. And I take pride in that. I take some comfort in that, knowing that he did what he wanted to do, and that's the way he died. You know, doing what he wanted to do, serving, and that is a comfort to me. And I want, that was part of the book, to teach children. I know you're sad you lost grandma or your brother, or your mother, or your father, but you can still be proud. You can walk around and say, I'm proud of my daddy. I'm proud of my mommy. You know, I'm proud of my sister and my brother because they served their country when they passed away. And, you know, and even if they didn't die in battle, they served, or they were a veteran or served their country or whatever, you know, they could take pride. But, you know, also, like I said, it was to teach children what a Purple Heart was. Yeah. So many people don't know what Purple Heart Medal is. I had to do my research. Where did it come from? You know, how did it come be? And I didn't know General George Washington made the Purple Heart. I didn't know that was his face in the middle of it.
Right.
You know, and why he made it. And so that's what the whole book explains. It's a grandfather explaining to a grandson what a Purple Heart is. So, you know, and brings up his father. I don't use the word death in the book. You know, so, you know, I tried to make it very, and the adults seem to really like the book, you know, because it's a book you're going to read to your kid more than you're just going to hand to your kid. And that's what I wanted it to be. And, you know, it's like that Dr. Seuss, I'm not.
Well, you know, I think as a parent, who has had conversations like this with his children, you know, like my kids asked about my brother, their uncle,
of course,
like who was he, what happened to him and things like that. And death is a tough topic to talk about with kids. And I think for the parents out there who maybe have experienced that type of thing, who have young children, having a book like this is like finding gold, because it can kind of help.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I wish everybody shared your sentiment, Scott. I mean, that would be great.
Seriously, because it's thinking to myself, how do I explain that to a young child, right? And you know, we're sitting down, and we used to do this all the time, especially when the kids were younger. We would, before bed, we would read them a story, and you know, they're having questions about certain things. Like maybe that's a story that you want to incorporate. Maybe not a bedtime story. I don't know. Maybe it is. Depends on your family situation, whatever you think is appropriate. But you know, sit down and read it with them. They have questions. You answer those questions, and you talk to them about it. And you know, but at least that introduces the topic. And I think this book could go even beyond military. I know it talks about the Purple Heart, which is unique to the military, but it could also be appropriate maybe for folks who are dealing with the loss of a, you know, law enforcement or firefighter or some other you know, loss like that as well, because it kind of broaches that difficult topic of you know, someone who's gone before, I'll call it gone before their time. You know, they had a lot of life left to live, but they sacrificed and they gave up the remaining years that they had so that others could have a better life. And
definitely gone before their time.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, that's you can fit several of those lifetimes in somebody else's lifetime. And, you know, it's sad when they're gone so soon. But especially to somebody who's so young, who just doesn't understand death, you know, like that person was just always here. Where did they go? You know, like there's some big questions there. Where did they go? If they're not here, where are they? You know, and you know, trying to talk to a child about that can be kind of difficult. So I think having a book like yours is truly amazing to have.
Well, thank you. And she won't let me really talk about my son to him. She didn't tell him until he was 8 years old that he had another father. Mm-hmm. And then, which was wrong, because then that freaked him out. He thought her current husband was the only man he knew. So he thought that was his partner. And so they kind of freaked him out. And she let me tell him. And then she put the gag order back on me. And okay, you told him, now shut up. You can't talk to him about it anymore. So he knows the book exists. I don't even know if he read the book from cover to cover. It sits on my counter. He could pick it up anytime he wants to, but she's got him so, I think, freaked out about death now that, you know, oh, don't talk about death because that upsets him. Like, well, you know, he's got to face this reality the same way you and I had to face the reality of losing somebody. And as sad as it is, but like you said, the book, can I show the book?
Yeah, sure. So, absolutely. Please.
And I'm going to have to put my glasses on. So here's the book. There's
My daddy's heart is purple. Yeah. And with the cover there. Yep.
Yes. And, you know, so, and there's, you know, Purple Heart.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone, you know, can see the Purple Heart. And then, you know, the book's not all sad. And, you know, some people, the adults, you know, some, it bothered me because I didn't want the book to make anybody cry. And some of the adults said, oh, you know, it made me cry. It made me cry. And I'm like, oh God, what did I do? Because, sorry about it, bumping the camera. I said that I didn't intend to it to be a sad book or to make people cry. And I ended up, you know, my last page is my favorite page. Last page was the hardest to come up with. You know, how do you end this? How do you end this little story? And I came up with I thought was a very nice last page. And so, you know, it's cute. It's uplifting. Like I said, you know, we lost somebody, but we're going to be proud of them. That's the message that the book was to send. Yes. Yeah. That's what it's got to send to these kids. And I was so honored when the principal called me. I had donated the book to our local library, which I wanted to make sure they were patriotic. Well, it just so happened that the lady that runs the children's library also has a son in the Air Force. He's a pilot in the Air Force. So I was very fortunate that she, said, oh, definitely, definitely we'll display your book or whatever.
That's great.
But I live in a small hick town, so that's not going anywhere. I was on the front cover of the newspaper and maybe two people saw it. So, you know, yeah. So, and then there was, when I gave her the book, she had called somebody apparently. And so the local newspaper again came down and took a picture of me handing her the book. So then that's how the principal called me of the elementary school. And I was a little ticked off because I'm old. And when I was a kid, we were off for Veterans Day.
Oh.
So it really disturbed me that the kids were no longer getting off for Veterans Day. Then when I found out, we live in a patriotic community. It depends on the community you live in, I guess, that supports the military. And then when I found out that the teachers were actually talking about the military and veterans and what Veterans Day was, I was very elated about that. I said, well, that's better than getting the day off.
Yeah. Yeah. My kids had something very similar. We homeschool our kids now, but, when they were in school, they had Veterans Day where they had to go to school, but it was all about veterans. And we live not even 10 miles from a Air Force base, Luke Air Force Base out here in Arizona. Right. And, so tons of military, around this area, between, you know, currently serving you know, veterans and everything like that. And they actually had an assembly where they invited the parents who were veterans, to come in, and, the kids did, they sang patriotic songs and they did all sorts of things like that. And some of the older veterans of World War II, veterans and, Korea veterans, they would get up and give speeches and talk to the kids and all that kind of stuff. But like you said, to me, I was like, that's better than having a day off where they just sit in front of a television.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, play video games or whatever, where they don't even know why they have the day off. I'd rather have them go to school and actually learn about what's this day about? Why is this even an important day? You know? And so yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that's the best way to do it. And so you're talking about, you know, the happiness and, you know, the sadness and all that kind of stuff as far as the book goes. I know when I wrote my book, I tried to incorporate, it was kind of a roller coaster of emotions because obviously it's a sad topic, you know, emotional and things like that. But I tried to include the funny stuff too. And so I think, like, if someone was to just sit down and read my book cover to cover, they'd have tears for maybe two reasons. One, because they're laughing so damn much, but another, because, you know, they might've cried too. But even in the writing process, I found it to be kind of a roller coaster of emotions, reliving some of the things. It's therapeutic at times to write about the topic, but, other times it was really sad. It was really difficult. It took me, you know, I'd write half a page and be like, I can't keep going right now. I got to take a break. And, you know, then I'll come back to it and maybe I can get back into it. But, what was your experience like writing, the book? Was it therapeutic for you? Was it difficult? I know you said it kind of just came to you, but, what was that like?
I'd read it and then I'll cry. It's like, you know, triggering it. But I'm very empathetic, I guess, and emotional. I'm too emotional. That's my problem. And yeah, it was, but like I said, it just came so quickly. I was like, I didn't even have to edit. I went back and my son that was my youngest son, he reads 4 books a week. So I handed him the manuscript and I said, okay, edit this for me. And he went through it and he said, Dad, there's nothing I would change. And I think the publisher, they asked me to change. There was one thing, one line, something they said, I think this would sound better. What do you think? The thing, you know, they gave me whatever. And I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. I can't even remember what it was. Maybe I repeated myself or something.
Yeah. Sure.
I could say that. But anyway, my main goal was selfish. It was for my grandson. It was a legacy to my grandson. It's like, if I drop dead tomorrow, my grandson can open this book and know how I felt and know how I feel that he should feel about his father. Because he doesn't know anything about his father, nothing about his father. And again, I'm not allowed to speak. I'm in that position, you know, it's speak about him and you won't see your grandson anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I keep counting the days. He's turning 14. I guess I got to live 4 more years till he turns 18 and I can get out from under the shackles, you know? And, you know, so I got to live 4 more years, folks. Pray I got to live 4 more years. But that's it. And like I said, when, you know, and I don't know how you feel about your book and people reading your book, and fortunately I haven't got to read your book. But when I saw that, when somebody had sent me the picture, emailed me, because I included my email in the book actually. Mm-hmm. And I said, tell me how you feel about the book. You can email me. And when I got that picture of a child reading my book, I was just blown away. I was like, I don't know this child. I don't know this person. I didn't expect it. I said, nobody will buy my book. Nobody cares. Nobody, you know, and even now it's still, okay, it's more toward children. It's more toward the military. So, you know, it's in a small category and for people, you know, to see it. And, but yet everybody that's seen it, not that many people has seen it, say they love it. Say they love the illustration. They love the book. They love the story. And I'm like, well, you know, my son's always saying, write another book, Dad, write another book, right? And I'm like, no, I just don't think I have it in me. I don't.
Well, you know, I think when you're writing a book like this and you start getting that outreach where people are writing to you and they're sending pictures and they're sending notes of, you know, basically how the book has helped them and they're sharing that type of stuff. I know for me, with my book, I've gotten similar messages from people. And some of the people were people I knew, people I grew up with, or people that knew my brother. But others were complete strangers, and they had, you know, maybe a similar circumstance where they lost a loved one, and they write to me, and they say, you know, how much the book had helped them, and how much they enjoyed reading the book, and things like that. But the one thing that really struck me as odd, I had done a bunch of television, radio, and other interviews and stuff like that to kind of help promote the book and get the word out about that. But I was in the grocery store one day, and this guy yells out my name, and I turned around. And I'm looking for a face I recognize. I'm like, you know, who is yelling my name? Couldn't find anybody that I recognized. And there's this guy walking towards me with his hand out, like he's gonna, you know, he wants to shake my hand. I'm like, oh, okay, fine. You know, like, this must have been the guy. And I'm racking my brain, who is this guy? Did I meet him someplace at some event? I just forgot who this person is and whatever. No, he had seen me on television and he recognized me. And so he called my name out. And, you know, it was like the most bizarre thing to get recognized for something like that. But also right. Knowing that the message got out there to somebody, you know, that was a good thing, you know?
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. It's like I said, you know, I'm not going to be recognized, nor I you know, my thing would be if this book would be in every elementary school.
Yeah.
Because like I said, and you know yourself as a veteran, the way times are changing and veterans just are not getting the respect that they got, you know, 50 years ago or even before then. You know, you watch the old movies, like even like Three Stooges, you can watch and how much a veteran, you know, you picked up the soldier on the side of the road, you know, I've taught my children to always, you know, the guys that wear the cap and I said, always go thank a veteran. And my children always walk up and thank a veteran. And, you know, I remember my son telling me that the pilot, he was flying one day and he was flying in uniform and the pilot bought him lunch. You know, he got off the plane and pilot bought him lunch or something. And it's like, you know, that's the way our soldiers used to be treated, yeah. You know, and, you know, I'll be in the airport and I don't carry much cash because everyone uses a plastic card now. And, you know, I'll dig for some cash and I'll, you know, I'll see a soldier and I'll say, hey, go buy a cup of coffee on me or whatever, you know, just to let them know that I appreciate them and I appreciate their service and, you know, what they do. And, you know, and then, you know, it was different living in Kings Bay, you know, everybody's in the Navy. And it's like, you know, and, you know, people who haven't experienced that, it's a whole different lifestyle. So they're here today, gone tomorrow somewhere, you know.
That's right. Yeah.
The kids are, well, I don't know if I'll be around, you know, daddy's going to get deployed, mama's going to get deployed, or we're going to get transferred somewhere else. So we don't know where we'll be living next year, but and it's nice knowing you. You know, it's nice knowing you. Yeah. So, you know, the life of an Army brat or, you know, whatever, a military brat. So, you know, that's what they did to me with my grandson. They knew daddy's in the military as well. And they kept telling me, oh, we're putting in for Japan. And, you know, my heart was broken. I said, okay, I've chased him from here. I've chased him from there. I'm not chasing my grandson to Japan. I can't go to Japan. You know, right. I, you know, and my heart was broken. Well, then he didn't go to Japan. And then I, you know, it just emotional turmoil for me all the time. You know, I was just gearing up for that loss. And then, oh, guess what? We're not going to Japan. Well, I'm so happy you're here, but now I've got to reprogram myself to welcome you back home or whatever. It's just,
it sounds like a roller coaster there with emotions, you know, going, you know, from the ups, the downs, and, you know, like, but the ups sometimes maybe don't feel like they're quite ups. It's like, you know, quasi victory, but, you know, it was like, at least you're not going to Japan, but, you know, still not as close maybe as you might want to be. Was there anything else outside of the kind of family, you know, family issues as far as like what the military support, like the support that you got through the Air Force, or anything like that, that you felt was maybe lacking or anything that you would like to see changed or different from on the military side?
Yeah. Like I said, originally, I think somebody in Congress needs to write a bill to protect parents such as your parents and myself, you know, when there's grandchildren. I have heard this horror story from many Gold Star families that they never saw their grandchildren. You know, she took the kids and split and they never, you know. And it's like, okay, you know, I lost my son or I lost my daughter, and now you're going to rip away my grandchildren from me. You're going to keep my grandchildren from me, you know, and she has all the power and I have none. And, it was hard, you know, I just worked hard, and I'm sure your parents can relate to this. I'm sure they would agree with me. Every parent's fear after losing a child is that child being forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, and I don't even go to family functions anymore because, you know, initially I'm jealous. I love my nieces and nephews, but I'm jealous that they're all growing up and having their careers and graduating college and doing all the things that I never got to experience, you know, losing my son so early in life. And then, you know, and then I see them playing as kids. You know, my son he was always the cut up. He would sit, my sister's got three girls, and my son would sit there and let, you know, as a teenager, as a 13-year-old, and let the girls do his hair, put little in his hair and do his hair and put lipstick on him. And he would let that, he loved kids, and he would let the kids do that to him. and he pretended he dressed up like a turkey once. He laid on a floor and pretended he was a turkey, and he was a smart ass too, I always say he liked to be a smart ass. So, he made Airman of the Year his second year in. And this was terrible of me. I hate myself. It's like, he calls me up. He goes, "Dad, I just got this email that I'm Airman of the Year." And I go, "Trey, come on. Someone's yanking your chain." I said, God, I hate myself to this day. I said, "Trey, come on. Someone's yanking your chain." Cause he was a sweet guy. He would do anything. And he was gullible in that sense. Cause he was a sweet kid. And I go, too sweet of a kid. And I go, come on, Trey, come on. So then finally he gets an email from someone high up, some command, and says, "Congratulations, he was still first class then or whatever. And, you've won Airman of the Year for your division." He was in the 88th Communications Squadron. So, he thought that Airman of the entire Air Force of the Year, but a 88th sure. Community, which was a big deal. And what is it? The highest up in there for the senior master sergeant, and that whatever the high of all is. He comes up to me and he goes, "I know your son." She goes, "Do you know how difficult that is to get that? My son's in." He goes, "My son never got anything." I didn't know. And so he came up and he brought me the award, a little crystal award about AI or whatever. I should have read out for you, obviously, but that's just bragging. And then it's like, when I said, since it was a Navy town, I said, "I'm going to the newspaper and I'm going to make sure." And he goes, "Don't do it, Dad." And I go, "I'm doing it." And I went to the newspaper. I made him take a picture of that award and put it in the newspaper, because I got so sick and tired of hearing Navy all the damn time. Like they were the only, that's all we heard about. And so, I said, "Oh no, there's other branches of the military here, son. And they're going to make, you live here and they're going to know." So, and I called my congressman, and then I got the big sign put up on the side of the road at the interchange.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's on I-95. If y'all ever go to the beach, in the Atlantic side, you guys are all going to go to the Pacific side, I guess. But, he did that. He also, if anybody here is medical, he also made medical history. So when he was shot, he didn't lose his arms and legs. He lost all the inside parts.
Hmm.
So he definitely was. I never knew the definition of exit wounds until it happened to my son. So he lost a lot of parts on the inside. And one of them was his pancreas. Well, you can't live very well without a pancreas. And it makes you, instantly a diabetic, a brittle diabetic. And the pancreas does other things. It produces enzymes and does other things. So for your audience doesn't know what the pancreas does, it makes your insulin. And without one, you're a diabetic.
Sure.
So this doctor at the University of Miami Medical School, Dr. Ricordi, he runs Diabetes Research Institute all over the world. It's called Diabetes Research Institute. And he swears he's going to cure diabetes before he dies. And I think he just hit 80, so he better hurry. So he developed this process, and my son was kind of the guinea pig. He'd already done it, but my son was the first person to ever get it due to a trauma.
Okay.
They had it due to cancer or something, but due to a trauma. So he was the first one. So he made medical history around the world. I mean, there was ticker tapes and I mean, he was in the Miami Herald all the way to the LA Times with these stories. I was in shock. Reader's Digest did a story on him called "Saving Trey." Before he died, he was in the Reader's Digest. There's a picture of him, his baby and baby mama and all that stuff. And it was called "Saving Trey." The story's Reader's Digest, ridiculous. It's
sure.
It's for entertainment. It's the Reader's Digest. Not disparaging the Reader's Digest, but a lot of the story was no, that's not. They called me to fact check, and I was like, just this print what you want. They're like, "No, but just print what you want to print." And so they did. And, but it was a good story. But then he's in the New England Journal of Medicine. He made a lot of doctors be known because of it. And But anyway, so he had no pancreas. They injected these cells into his liver. His liver started producing insulin. Somebody went down to Florida to Ripley's Believe It or Not. And I get this picture from someone in the Army that knew my son. And I get this picture from Ripley's Believe It or Not. And there's a big poster of my son in there. And it says, Believe It or Not, this man lived without a pancreas and his liver produced insulin. And he wasn't on insulin. And he told me the story after he left Walter Reed. And he was still active duty on medical leave, I guess is what they call it. And because I kept saying they were going to throw him out. I thought they were going to throw him out. But then they didn't throw him out because his body was producing insulin. So I had high hopes that he was going to make it. And he just laid down one day and didn't get back up. But I always say you can't live on Mountain Dew and morphine is what I've always said. Can't live on Mountain Dew and morphine. He said it was painful to eat. He could, he lost so many organs and he said it was just painful. And, but yet he was living without a pancreas and no insulin. So it was a medical miracle. And, like I said, it got a lot of, if you Google his name, it's just, I was a realtor. And I would try to check up on myself. Let's see how this guy is doing. Is anyone talking about him? And I can't type in my name because story after story of him, because who am I? I'm a nobody. But story after story of him, because he made this medical history, pops up pictures that I never saw, pictures of him in Afghanistan, pictures of him, pictures I never saw. I saw an interview, him doing an interview, a TV interview with somebody at some local station. And I had to turn it off. It just tore me up. I couldn't take it. And, he was explaining graphically, about himself and how his lunch was in his hands and things like that. And, somebody had to put him kind of back together, throw him on a helicopter, get him to Kabul and get him. Then he went to, I always say this wrong,
Ramstein.
Ramstein, yeah.
I've never been there, so I don't know.
Germany, he went from Afghanistan to Germany to Walter Reed, and that's where he stayed most of the last part of his life in Walter Reed.
And how long did he live after a year and a week.
And he destroyed Thanksgiving. He had his first surgery on Thanksgiving Day. These doctors gave up their Thanksgiving. They came. One of the doctors said to me, look, we don't know if he's really going to make it through the surgery. Just want you to know. And I sat out in the rain and I thought it was very appropriate because it was raining and, with my bone waiting for him to come out of surgery to see, that's when they were doing the transplant surgery. And, he was a lot worse than I was told, and I was expecting something like a cartoon, I was expecting to see my son sitting up being a smart ass, with a couple bandages around him. And I had no clue he was as bad as he was.
Yeah.
So, he was in intensive care and I woke him up. I regretted that to this day, because he was in so much pain, they had him in the propofol coma, so to speak. And, I said, they said, we're just having a hard time waking him up. And I said, he was intubated, and watching her kid with 50 tubes running in and out of him and being, intubated and everything. And this hearing the breathing and all the pumps and I'm a nurse. So I was kind of used to that, but not with your own child.
Yeah. And then it's different. Yeah.
And I said to the doc, I go, if I can wake him up, will you take the tube out? And they said, well, if he can breathe on his own, we'll take out the tube. If he can breathe on his own, I woke him up. He woke up. He responded to my voice. Sorry.
It's okay.
Get through that.
I think it doesn't matter if it was 100 years. It'll still be difficult.
I just I always regretted. I always regretted waking him up because he was in so much pain. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Can you put him back? Can you put him back to sleep?" And they said, "No." And I said, "Oh." So then he stayed awake and he talked and he was happy I was there and he chatted and he says, "Where am I?" And I told him, and all he said was, he said, "You know, that bastard shot me." And I said, "Yeah, he did." I said, "Let's not talk about him. Let's talk about you. You know, how you doing?" "Oh, okay." He had no clue what was wrong with him. No clue. So, he was in really bad shape. Thought, and this is the funny part, shouldn't be fun. So the next day, we're in intensive care and the nurse came in and he was cranky with her. He was real cranky with her. And I said, "Trey, stop being cranky with the nurse. And I know you're in a lot of pain, but you're hurting me and all this stuff." And the nurse wasn't liking his attitude. And he said, "Dad, I want you to give me a bath or something like that." And I said, "Why?" He goes, "You do it." And I'm like, "Oh, gee, thanks." My sister, she just jumped on a plane and came to support me and his fiance was there with child, and she was pregnant, and I said something to him about Trey, if you, because like I said, he was a smart, I said, "You smart off like that to me again and I'm gonna slam that door with your two something." And he said, "Dad, I said something relating to his parts. And he said, "Dad, I don't have a penis." I said, "What?" And he goes, "I don't have a penis." And I said, "Yes, you did, Trey." And he goes, "I'll bet you $500 I don't." And I said, ladies, leave the room. Please leave the room. And they all left the room. And I called the nurse and I said, "Nurse, would you please show my son his penis and tell him he has a penis?" And all I could think of my son, I was a nurse, but he wasn't medical. All I could think of is my son heard, "Sir, you don't have a pancreas." That's what he heard. "You don't have a pancreas."
Oh my gosh.
And yeah, he heard he didn't have a pancreas and he heard penis and he thought he didn't have a penis anymore.
Oh, wow.
Of course, he's, under all this morphine and everything. And so, yeah. So, I later told that story under my tears at a banquet later. After he had passed, I was invited to, it's a banquet from, I don't know if you're familiar with the Maupin story, Matt Maupin story.
No.
His unit was taken hostage in Iraq and, what year, 06 or anyway, and his son never came back. Keith Maupin, he's been on the news a lot. He started the Yellow Ribbon.
Okay.
So have you seen my son? So he was sending the packages. Have you seen my son, him and his wife? Have you seen my son? Have you seen my son? Well, it turned out they had killed him and he had to fight Congress to get the remains sent back. So every year there's a banquet in Ohio. It's called the Yellow Ribbon Scholarship Fund, and we go and they raise money, and then I give a scholarship away in my son's name at his high school. So, which was a really nice thing that he started. And but like I said, they said, "Would you like to come to this banquet?" And I said, "Well, okay." And they said, we'll fly you here and we'll put you up in a room." And I said, "Oh, okay." I was a little, my son had just passed. I was still in shock. But somebody had told these people that she was from Ohio. She was from that area. And she's also a veteran. And her husband's also was a friend of my son's in the Air Force. So I show up to this place. And then she said, "Oh, would you like to say a few words?" And I'm like, okay. I show up to this place. I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be a church basement, 50 people.
Yeah.
I show up to this banquet. There's 800 people. A stage with spotlights, and there's senators there and people from the Cincinnati Bengals are there. And I'm like, oh. So I told the story that I just told your audience about. I didn't know what to say. And so I was trying not to cry. So I told the story. And the doctor actually had come and sponsored that was developed the thing. And he was like shaking his head. You're telling it all wrong. You're telling it all wrong about the transplant. But he was like, you know, yes and no. I could say right. About the transplant surgery. But
the gist anyways for the as far as
then I went to the bathroom and cried. So because I had a hard time. I don't know about your parents, but I couldn't even say his name. Mm-hmm. It took me 5 years to be able to speak his name without crying. And I go, God, what the hell is wrong with me? I couldn't even speak his name. And I'm sorry I lost it there. I'm still so upset with myself with that guilt of waking him up. And every time I hated that I woke him up and I just regretted it. But I was scared that if he didn't wake up, I would never see him again. That was the end.
Well, you know what though? You said this, that, you know, he was talking with you. He was happy to see you, that type of thing. You gave him that, right? That was, if I'm thinking of, how would I want to go out? I don't want to be going out in a drug-induced coma. I want to have my loved ones around me and be able to, see them, talk to them, and, right up to the end. That's me. I don't know. Everybody's going to be different, but, and even how you handle the loss, the grief. I think that's important for folks to remember too, is there's no right way to handle it. I mean, everyone's going to handle it differently. There's certainly wrong things. You don't want to, seep into a depression where you're drinking and doing drugs and doing all these other things, right?
I planned on that. I said, I'm going to sit where the kids are in school, I'm going to sit at the bar, cry in my beer, and I'm going to get drunk.
Yeah.
And the weird part is, it's like after my son died, I just lost my desire. I wasn't much of a drinker anyway, but I lost my desire for alcohol. I just did not even want. I did not even want to. And I didn't want to go on antidepressants. I didn't want to.
Yeah.
I should. I'm sure I would have been much easier to get along with. So I didn't even want to sleep in my bed. I slept in. I honestly sat there and I watched reruns of Everybody Loves Raymond. I had watched. The only thing that got me through the biggest part of my depression was watching sitcoms. I love sitcoms. Love to laugh. I used to be the cut up guy, the life of the party. I'm always got to come back with the smart ass jokes. I mean, that's just me. I'm the that's what she said guy. And my kids, raising all boys, it's pretty bad because we just get pretty bad sometimes. And it's sure. Like, okay, we're going to be around the ladies. We got to curb it.
Yeah,
a little bit. And my sisters roll their eyes, and all that stuff. It's like,
that's funny.
So, yeah. And I want to be that guy again. My one sister that's under me, we're close and she's in Tennessee and she's a nurse, and she's always like, oh, please come to my party. Please. You're the life of the party. Everyone gets boring. And you always, I'm just a smart ass. And I just, say stuff that other people won't say. And it's not dirty stuff or bad stuff. I just,
it's keeping life fun, right? It's just having, enjoying the conversation, making little jokes, sometimes catches people off guard, which is, I think, part of being funny. If it was predictable and you knew it was coming, it wouldn't be all that funny, but you got to be a little spontaneous with it, right?
My baby sister is a handful. She's I think she's spoiled and she thinks she's, abused and, the abused child. And we all think she's the spoiled child. And so it's just, I go to visit her one day. Again, we're all in Tennessee, and I go to visit her and she holds up this big B that's about her last name starts with a B, and she's got this big B, and she holds it up, and she wanted to hang it over her fireplace, and she goes, and her husband was sitting there, and her husband, he's scared of her. He's just like, anything, don't say anything. And, you know, she's my baby sister. I don't give a crap. It's like, you're my baby sister. I'm the big brother. Shut up. So she goes, what do you think of my big B? And I said, well, if it stands for bitch, it's very appropriate. And her husband almost fell out of the chair. He was dying. And she just got this look on her face. Guess what? The B came down. She took it down. And it's there no more. So, I mean, that's just kind of my witty sense of humor. I'll say things, and my other sisters are over there like, you know,
Yeah, right.
They're, oh, God, always doesn't start on me, you know? And it's like, and, you know, they'll start on me, and they know better because I'll get them back really good. And, you know, because I'm the only brother of four sisters, and it's just, it's hell. It's hell. You know, I feel bad for you, Scott. You know, you lost your brother, and I mean, I know that's hard. I wish I had a brother. I have a half brother, but we weren't raised together.
Mm-hmm.
He's second family. I don't know if you've ever experienced that. So, you know,
no.
And then, you know, my dad remarried a woman and he went back to Italy. I had him deported. I tell everyone, I had him deported. The dad just went to Italy. You're not happy. You know, he's using me. He's totally American, you know, perfect English. I speak spaghetti. Do you speak Italian?
No.
I speak shitty Italian. And you know, he never spoke Italian because my mom was German. And so he always spoke English. And you know, I always regret it because I didn't meet my grandparents till I was 19.
Oh, wow.
And I instantly fell in love with my grandmother and my grandfather. And I had never met them. And I only saw them 2 months of my whole life before they passed away. Hmm. So, you know, he's from a little village. And I said, Dad, you know, his father had passed. His mother had a stroke. I said, Dad, go be with your mother. He said something about moving with me. I said, you wouldn't be happy in Tennessee because he lived in Chicago. No. I said, you'll never be happy in Tennessee. You won't be happy here. You know, and he was very social. And I said, just go back to Italy. Go back and be with your mother. Spend your last days with her. So he did. And then he met a woman from Albania. All the women, and he had Albania. So she's a nice lady. She took very good care of him up until the day he died. She did take very good care of him. She's a wonderful person, and you know, but we're different, very different. Albanian, sure. American,
sure.
Yeah, it's a whole different dynamic.
Well, before we wrap up this show, I got a couple things here that I want to put out there. First. Towards the end of the show, I like to add a little bit of humor. I know we kind of had a little bit of laugh just a minute ago. But sometimes the topics that we talk about, they're kind of heavy, dark, you know, kind of topics. And, you know, having a little humor at the end of the episode, I kind of equate it to having dessert at the end of a meal. Kind of puts a good taste in your mouth and makes you a little bit happy. Right. Sometimes that might be the only smile someone gets on their face all day. So what the hell? I'm willing to make a fool out of myself with a corny joke if it'll put a smile on somebody's face. So if you don't mind humoring me just for a second, for just a...
No, I love humor. I'm all about humor.
I know. So. I kind of figured you wouldn't mind.
I don't mind.
Even though this is kind of corny.
So, and it doesn't have to filter either. I don't care.
Yeah.
I am not easily offended.
Sure. So I told my boss that there were three companies that were after me and I needed a raise to stay at my job. So we haggled for a few minutes and he gave me a 5% raise. And as I was leaving his office, he stopped and he asked me, by the way, which companies were after you? And I said, the gas, electric, and cable companies.
Yeah. I think you need more than 5% right now.
Yeah. At this point, yeah, we need a little bit more than that. That was maybe underestimating how much you might need. But Carl, before we wrap this up, it has been a pleasure speaking with you, learning about you and your family and everything that you went through, and also learning about the book that you wrote. You know, again, the book is My Daddy's Heart is Purple. The photo of your son. No. That's your son there. And
that, right before he, see, that's when we lived in Florida, the tan, he came down. Oh, yeah. That was right before he deployed to Afghanistan.
He kind of looked like a beach bum in the picture there.
Yeah, it was right before we deployed, and he loved the beach life. He loved the ocean. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Where can people go to get a copy of your book?
Anywhere. It's mostly online. You have to order it. It's print on demand. And here it is again. If people want to see the cover of it or whatever, if they can see this. So mostly Amazon.
Sure.
And I mean, it's on Barnes and Noble has it. And I think you can go on eBay and type it into eBay and
probably can find it there too. Yeah.
Oh yeah. You know,
I found that too with my book after a little while after it's been out, people sell it on, secondhand market and, things like that. So you can find it probably just about anywhere, but I'll put a link to the book in the show notes for the listeners so you can grab a copy of the book. Again, Carl, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you, and I appreciate you taking the time to come on and share your story.
Well, I appreciate you having me, Scott. I mean, I appreciate your service very much.
Thank you.
To you and your sacrifice and your parents. And please tell your parents my heart goes out to them. I know what they're going through. And I hope people understand it, whether it's 13 days, 13 years. My son ruined Thanksgiving and Christmas for me. I mean, I haven't celebrated Thanksgiving because he passed on that week. And the year before, he was having surgery on Thanksgiving Day at Walter Reed. And then the year later, he passed away at Thanksgiving weekend. And I said, really, Trey? And then I'm shopping for funeral clothes for my kids, and the Christmas music is playing because I buried him the first week of December. So I said, so now you ruined Christmas and Thanksgiving. Thank you very much. And, I'll look at his pictures like, yeah, it's another Thanksgiving, but I did cook a turkey. I have a couple foster kids and my son lives here, his youngest brother. So I actually cooked a turkey this year. I actually sucked it up and cooked a turkey and made a nice dinner. And I just don't want to be around people,
Well, and I think that's kind of an important thing to realize too, is everybody's going to handle the grief differently, and especially different times of years, different holiday, there might be birthdays or holidays like Thanksgiving.
Oh, holidays are.
Yeah.
And I want to thank all your viewers, all the veterans and the veteran supporters, and thank you for your service. Thank you for your sacrifice.
Sure.
Never stop being proud. And like I would say to your parents, the same I say to every other parent in my book, I say, don't let people tell you how to feel. Nothing is worse than that. Everyone's I know how you feel. And if one more person tells me how they feel because their dog died, I'm going to lose. Well, he was like a family member to me. And I don't know, I know you loved your dog, but please, please don't equate your dog to the passing of my child. Please don't do that. Or your cat. Or your hamster.
Sure.
Forever. That's it. Do you have time for one little funny story?
We can do another one. Sure.
Well, I know you said not to get political, but
that's okay.
My son was not a big fan of Barack Obama, and he was in during Barack Obama's time. So, everyone in all the military people kept saying, what can we do for your son? I said, well, tell the president to come over here and give my son his Purple Heart. That's what they go over. I said, I want the president to come over. And well, he never did. He never did. And so my son, we weren't big fans. And he would go down. He couldn't eat much. He could walk. He could walk and he could talk again after all the raspiness went away. And he would go down to the cafeteria, and he lived on milkshakes, and he would get a milkshake. So he was going down. He said he went down. He was, I forgot, ninth floor, whatever. He was at Walter Reed. And he said the elevator stopped halfway down, and he said the door's open, and he said, there stood Barack Obama. I said, oh, well, son, what'd you do? Did you get out and shake his hand? He said, no, I let the doors close. And I'm sorry, but
it's okay. That's
when he said that, it's just one moment I always remember, and I'll never forget him. And wait, I let the doors close. And I'm like, I don't care if you voted for him. I don't care. He was the president. You should have get out and shook his hand or something. And we did meet Joe Biden later. Okay. You did meet him. And so anyway, he squeezed my knee. He didn't touch me. We were sitting knee to knee, and he bent over and he squeezed my thigh. Actually, I said, I'm glad I wasn't very elongated there, because, you know, he might've grabbed something off. And I really kind of defended him, because I said, he talks with his hands like me, and he's very animated, and he's a touchy feely guy. And a lot of people complain about that. And I actually sort of defended it at the beginning. I said, no, he doesn't mean anything by it. But then, you know, after time went on, I really couldn't defend the hair snipping anymore or anything. So, but he did, he bent over and he grabbed me the thigh and he said, you need anything, you just call me, and that's no bullshit. And I said, he flipped over a card and he wrote, I got the card. He wrote Joe Biden. He wrote the phone number. And Jill was walking around and he didn't know his phone number. Imagine that. He didn't. He said, honey, she was walking. And he snapped his fingers and she'd already come by and took a picture with Trey. She was walking. He said, honey, what's my phone number over there? And remember, he was just vice president then. So yeah.
Sure.
And she said, I don't know. And I was like, damn. I want to say, lady, she's vice president. She don't talk to him that way. And I did show great. I sure respected him. And, you know, as he approached and I stood up, he goes, you don't have to stand. I said, yes, I do. You're the vice president. And yes, I do. But so he called over his assistant that was standing in the background doing all the photos, and he stayed out of the way, and he snapped and he came over. He said, what's my phone number over there? And he jotted down the phone number. And so anyway, that's
funny. Oh my gosh.
I'll say Joe Biden touched me, and they go, fucking, you're stupid. Don't believe me. I think honest to God, and my hand to God, if Joe Biden didn't squeeze me on the thigh, I will rot in hell. And it's true. And I'll say something. They go, okay, this guy's flaky. He's lost it. Oh, yes, I did meet Joe. I did.
That's funny. Well, thank you again for not only coming on the show, but thank you for sharing all these stories. I don't think I've laughed so hard on an episode with a topic, serious as this. So I appreciate the humor and the levity that kind of comes along with it. So thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate you. And like I said, all I ask is, if nobody wants the book, just get it and donate it to your children's school. We can't let these children forget about our veterans. We can't let these children forget about people who serve and sacrifice like you, Scott, and your children can't never, your children know through you, but are they going to know through other people? Are their friends going to know, we've got to let people know. And it's just you and I and everybody on here is just one way to do that.
That's right.
Keep the pride. Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to support the show, please check out Scott's book, Surviving Son, on Amazon. All of the sales from that book go directly back into this podcast and work to help veterans in need. You can also follow the Drive On Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and wherever you listen to podcasts.